my breasts were like towers. Then I was in his eyes as one who brings peace. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. My vineyard, my very own, is for myself. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and the keepers of the fruit 200. O you who dwell in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountain of spices. And so ends Song of Songs. Yeah, almost like sketch notes of what they were going to write in Song of Songs 1 through 7. Here they are. Like, it's like you get the finished product of the artwork, and then at the appendix, you get like the sketches they did ahead of time. And in fact, much of this language we've heard before.
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, not just the language, but even the themes of certain of them. Like, oh, that like, harkens back to this chapter, that harkens back to that chapter. But it's like, it was the outline.
Right, Melinda was saying that you hear in this section so much that harkens back to previous chapters, as if this was almost like an outline, and then they wrote the whole book from it. Gives it a feel like that. Okay, well, let me ask you this, just with someone sitting next to you, just share whatever stood out in this particular chapter, whether it was that, or a line, or an image, or something like that, just to get us thinking about it. What stood out for you? And then we'll go through it more verse by verse, and just see what we see. You want to do this until... Oh, you already have one. Okay, I'll put this back. I didn't know you. Okay, hopefully you had a chance to share just a little bit, or at least think about a part that stood out to you. Let's go ahead and go back through it one more time. This time, I'll share with you just some thoughts about the letter of the passage, as we've been calling it. You know, the historical context, what the words mean, associations with other parts of the book, the surface of it. And while we do that, let me encourage you to attend to this. This is obviously, as we've talked about, a celebration of human intimacy. And at the very same time, a celebration and acknowledgement of human divine intimacy. And so on every thought you have, everything that stands out to you, it is worthwhile to ask yourself, what does this say to me on a human level? And what does it say to me on a, maybe we'll call it a spiritual level? Because it is meant to speak to both simultaneously. Okay, verse 1. Oh, that you were like a brother to me. Language, as Melinda was pointing out, that we have heard before, who nursed at my mother's breast. This is language we've heard before coming from the beloved to the lover. This time it's lover to beloved. Where he would say to her, oh, that you were a sister to me. Or called her my sister, my bride. The key word here is like. Oh, that you were like a brother to me. It was not common for siblings ever to marry in ancient Israel. That's not what's being promoted here. It's more along the lines of, then I could just freely hold on to you in public, right? You could come to my house and no one would care. It'd be no big deal. If I met you outside, I would kiss you like you could a sister could kiss a brother. No one would despise me. It is a little bit funny that there is this language of no one would despise me, as if their love is a secret, because the whole poem has been very public. You know, I mean, like, there's been no secret at all. Even the women of Jerusalem are singing about it. Like, everyone knows about this. You know, you guys are together. So it is a little strange. But it is at least worth asking ourselves, are there times when love is not able to be expressed publicly? For whatever reasons. And what might this be saying about that? That plea, oh, that I would be able to be more public with my love. So there is that in here. I would lead you and bring you into my mother's house, into the chamber of the one who bore me. In other words, you could come over and no one would care. I would give you spiced wine to drink from the juice of my pomegranates. This is imagery we have heard regularly enough in chapters 1 through 7 over and over again. And I will trust that it is sufficiently clear to need no further comment from me. And then, verses 3 through 4. Oh, that his left hand were under my head. Oh, that his right hand embraced me. The NRSV translation makes this sort of into a wish. Oh, that this was the case. Other translations, because the Hebrew could be read in more than one way here, make it more like a declarative statement. His hand is under my head. His hand does embrace me. It could be read in either way here. Most people think this is probably a fragment, sort of like we were talking about, because chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, has this exact same set of lines. They're just longer, more filled out, a fuller version of it. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready. This is, again, exactly like chapter 2, verse 7. It does leave out what chapter 2, verse 7 says. It's, I charge you, remember, by the wild does and the gazelles, the gazelles and the wild does, do not stir up or waken love until it is ready. Not 100% certain what that's meant to be saying. Perhaps just someone saying, hey, don't wake my lover up. I want this moment to last as long as possible. Perhaps that's what it's saying. Others suggest it's simply just saying, look, this type of love needs to develop slowly and over time. You just cannot rush this. As great as it is, allow it to develop at the pace it needs to develop. Don't expect it to be full on in one moment. Perhaps that's what's being said here. Again, it's always interesting to ask, what does that mean on a human level? What does that mean on a human divine level? Okay. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? This is the third time in the song the author asks, who is entering the scene all of a sudden? This is a very short fragment. Feels like maybe we're missing something here. Who knows? But it's what we have. We don't know why they were in the wilderness, why the lover needs to lean upon her beloved, or is just simply choosing to lean upon her beloved, and we don't know where they're headed. A lot of commentators have compared those two lines, who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved, particularly when it's read in the Hebrew, it feels a bit almost like a haiku. But again, no one's certain and wonders, could it be more or part of a haiku or a full haiku? No one knows for sure. But then the scene switches all of a sudden. Under the apple tree, I awakened you. There, your mother was in labor with you. There, she who bore you was in labor. Again, historically, there is very little known about what this might mean. There certainly seems to be some link in the Song of Songs between love and birth. So where you were born and our love and birth together. But again, there feels like a key is missing here to fully understand what the letter at least means. The good news is the Spirit can still use even a weird letter to say something to us. And so perhaps we will discover something here that the scholars and biblical historians can't quite figure out. Again, it's almost wonderful that we can't figure it out, because it leaves it wide open for a spiritual reading if we see fit. And then we come to verses 6 through 7. This passage here and this one here, many presume this is the entire summary and heart of the whole book. Again, it seems like its own separate fragment of a poem here. These next two verses seem like the center of everything. In the end, here's what I'm trying to say, the song is suggesting. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. The lover asks to be the beloved's seal. Most commentators say this doesn't seem to be a simile, but a literal request. In the ancient world, a person's seal, like you can imagine kings who stamped their seal on something when they sent it off, a person's seal was the statement and guarantee of their identity. And therefore, your seal was kept close and safe. It was essential because your identity was tied to your seal. And as the lover in this section, set me as a seal upon your heart, a seal upon your arm, wants the beloved to take her as a visible mark of his own identity. And again, you can imagine what that might mean between two humans. What might that mean between humans and God? Creation saying to God, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a mark of your very identity, God. The lover wants to be, in a sense, indispensable to the beloved's being and identity. The lover wants to be one flesh with the beloved. For love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Perhaps somewhat surprisingly, this is the first and only time in the entire Song of Songs when love itself, not their love between one another, but love itself as a force, is lauded, is talked about. Every other time it's been, you know, their love for one another, but love itself is only talked about in this passage. And so, let me read this section and then come back to this. Love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. What's interesting here is some of this language. Death, flame, many waters, wealth, that we just read in that passage. Those words in Hebrew, as it turns out, they're the names of four very prominent gods during ancient Israelite world. So death was the name of a god of death. That one's obvious. Flame was the name of the god of pestilence. So you can imagine pestilence is very destructive in their world. The word flame was that god's name. Many waters, on the next slide, many waters is the name of the god of chaos. We translate that word many waters, but in Hebrew, it's the literal name of the god of chaos. Wealth is the god of mammon, as we hear about in the New Testament. So what's intriguing here, it's almost as if all these gods are a challenge to love, and this poem is saying, you know what? Love is strong as the god of death. God with the lowercase g, right? Love is... its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Like love competes with that god of pestilence. Many waters cannot quench it. The god of chaos cannot quench love. Neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth, the god of mammon of one's house, it would be utterly scorned. Almost as if to say, again, this is the first time that love as an entity has been talked about and praised, almost as if to say, there's another god worth competing with here. And that god's name is, 1 John 4:8, love. That god is stronger than all these other gods that will try and destroy it. So again, this seems to be the heart of the passage here. And then we move on, and we change topics once again. I mean, we're only like 7 verses in and already like 8 different topics. All of a sudden, now there's these brothers, apparently, companions, who've never spoken the entire psalm, and here they are. we have a little sister. She has no breasts. The idea there is that she's not old enough to be married. That's the idea. That's what the language is saying there. What shall we do for our sister on the day when she is spoken for, when she is old enough to be married? And then there's this really interesting language. If she is a wall, we'll build upon her a battlement of silver. If she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. What in the world is wall and door all about? Now, we can talk about spiritual applications. Here's just sort of a literal, on the surface, understanding of it. Wall stood for a way of life that was secure. You know, the wall, like, is a protection. It's a way of life that is secure against temptations to whatever is the opposite of love. You know, like, we live in a world where we talk about, it's too bad there's so much hate in the world, or you know, so much constant arguing and condemning and separating, right? Whatever the opposite of love is, we find ourselves tempted to it all the time, even when we don't mean it. The wall was a character that was secure against temptations to the opposite, whatever the opposite of love is. Whereas a door, you know, a door is something that opens and you can pass through, in and out. Door was sort of symbolic of character that was not immune to the temptations to whatever is the opposite of love. The door is the person who easily jumps into hate, easily jumps into envy, easily jumps into jealousy. And so they say, look, if she's a wall, we will praise her and build a battlement of silver. If she's a door, well, then we'll help her. We'll try and provide something that helps her focus on love and not its opposite. Again, not entirely unlike what we try and do for one another, building one another up, equipping one another for good works. And then it jumps from when our sister was young and wasn't at the age of marriage. All of a sudden now it's the daughter, it's the woman talking, it's the lover talking, and she is of marrying age. And so we've skipped ahead many years, and she said, I was a wall. In other words, I was not tempted by whatever the opposite of love is. It did not tempt me. And then my breasts were like towers. You don't need to adorn me. Just ask my lover. I am already the very thing my beloved needs and wants. I'm already that, as one who brings peace. That word peace has shown up multiple times. Peace is the root of the word Solomon. We've heard the name Solomon multiple times. Peace is the root of the word Shulamite, the Shulamite name that was given. Peace has been talked about many times, almost as if to say here in closing, this love we share is ultimately what is going to bring peace. What's intriguing is it's the lover, the female character, saying to the beloved, the male character, again, sort of the opposite of what you'd expect culturally at their time, is that the beloved, the male character, is not complete until I bring him peace. Again, allegorically speaking, that's creation, saying to God, you are not complete until we choose to come and bring you peace. It's quite a statement being made in the Song of Songs here. Okay, but we can come back to that. And then we've ended with that little fragment. Here's a new fragment. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. No one ever has found Baal Hamon. No one knows what it means. I mean, no one knows what the place is. But the word Baal Hamon is like Lord of Abundance. It was commonly thought among Christians and Jews that the talk of Solomon's vineyard code language for his harem, right, that you hear about, was a massive exaggeration. You know, it talks about this huge harem he had, just to say it was large, right? So he had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. Many people suggest that Solomon's harem was symbolic of all the various ways you might fall into idolatry, since Solomon was the first of the kings to lead the nations into idolatry at the end. If that's what's being said here, the beloved, the male character who's now talking, says, my vineyard, again, that's symbolic language, my very own is for myself. You, O Solomon, you can keep all of that that leads me away from true love. The keepers can keep whatever rewards they get from all of that. I am satisfied with this true love before me. I don't need all those other temptations out there. This completes me. Almost perhaps a rejection on a spiritual level of all the various ways we can be tempted to move away from love. Seems to be what's being suggested here. The way that abundance, the Lord of abundance, always tempts us away. We want abundance, so we're willing to do evil to get it. And the beloved is saying, not me. Not me. What I need is right here and nothing more. I won't be tempted by all that other stuff. And then we switch to another fragment. And here we are, two more to go. Oh, you who dwell in the gardens, my companions are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. Theologians are completely uncertain what this little fragment means. The speaker is female here, given the gender of the words in Hebrew. The companions are male, so it's the lover saying, oh, you who dwell in the garden, my companions, these male companions, are listening for your voice. Let me hear it. We don't have any other information about this little fragment on what it might mean. Maybe there was a longer poem connected to it that's lost. Who knows? But it's what we have. And allegorically, you can at least hear that cry for, I want to hear your voice, God. Where are you? Let me hear you once again, perhaps. And then finally, there's this. Make haste, my beloved. That word that the NRSV translates, make haste, it can also mean flee. So it's sort of weird here. You got to make a choice. Is the lover saying, come or get out of here? It could go either way. NRSV presumes it means come. Most commentators do think it means come to me, given the whole context of the poem. But interestingly, it could mean flee. It could mean get away. So it's sort of intriguing. Make haste, my beloved. And then it returns to the language of the gazelle or the young stag upon the mountain of spices. It's almost like it ends by starting again. All of the Song of Songs, this love poem, has been this constant cycle of reminding us you don't just arrive at love. You get there and then you work at it again. And then you arrive and then you work at it again. And it's this ongoing cycle of practicing it over and over and over. And so they repeat the same things they said because it matters to keep saying those things to your beloved. It matters to keep saying those things to your lover. I do love you. You are beautiful in my eyes. You got to keep saying it. You know, it's on and on and on. And so, interestingly, the whole Song of Songs ends, the very last verse, by let's start again. Let's go back to the beginning and do this whole cycle once more. Make haste. Be like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of spices. That's just where they began. And now they've completed. And now they're starting the cycle all again, as if to say, now go back to verse 1 of chapter 1 and read it all again. So that is where it ends. Make haste, my beloved. Come yet again. Okay, so there we go. A variety of fragments, it seems like, in chapter 8 here. Summaries of all that we've heard. Again, the same sort of message we've heard all along. But I wonder this time, what have you heard? Now that we've talked about this for 8 chapters, now that we've gone through everything, you've heard this imagery, this language, what stands out? What might the Spirit of God be speaking to us today? Pay attention to whatever word you're receiving. Let's speak those aloud and see what we hear. Dan and then Melinda.
You're kind of leading into it, I think it's at the end, but the sense that I've got from this, the whole thing, there was no beginning and there is no end. And usually when we think about the language that's used in this, we think about the young, the beginning of a relationship.
Right.
The early
right.
infatuation and the romanticism and all that. Well, this is continuing all the way throughout. And so it seems like, yeah, this is just what it is. you're not going to go, there is no beginning and end to it. This is all mm-hmm. of it. So
yeah.
That's a sense that I got from the whole
right.
reading. The two pieces that you talked about in the middle that was important.
Yes. Yeah.
Was
verses
a summary,
six or seven. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that until you're talking about it. But the Hindi concept of death has five stages, and the two stages before freedom and then total union are fire and water.
Hmm.
Excuse me, or actually water and fire.
Water and fire, yeah.
And then, which leads into then what might be considered a freedom towards love, and then once you get to there, then it's complete union. There's no there's no beginning, there's no end. It's a field without edges.
Right. Oh, lovely imagery, yeah.
Oh,
that's good.
I never thought about that until
right.
you mentioned and just pointed out those pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
And
oh,
and India's not that far away.
Yeah, and I love that connection. Thanks for pointing that out. We wouldn't have known that, so that's great. And I really appreciate the sentiment that the song, it does seem to say the journey is the thing. We have in mind beginnings and endings, and no doubt that's useful to some degree. But it's the song seems to say over and over again, look, it's the journey that's the thing. In other words, attend to now. Attend to the present. Attend to this moment and seek love here. Not when you get there, when you arrive here, now. The journey is the thing. It's not about the beginning or the end, but now. And it's just a great reminder. Melinda?
So I love it when multiple things that you're doing all kind of together.
Right, right.
Other books that I'm reading, other things that I'm learning, all coming together. And so, you know, I just finished for the second time reading Braving the Wilderness by Brené Brown.
Okay.
And in it, she really wrestles with her, what sent her on this journey was this deep sense of not belonging her entire life. And finally, it's this conversation that she has with her husband. And he's like, but you do belong. You belong to me. You belong to our kids.
Hmm.
You belong to... And then I am hearing this, and especially at
right.
the end,
oh,
you know,
good.
where the brothers were talking about what if, what if, what if. And then she's like, wait, but no. No. I do belong.
Hmm.
I belong to my beloved, and my beloved belongs to me. And then I started to think, that's what it's been about the entire time. This is somebody who maybe wasn't beautiful in the eyes of society. Maybe, and there's this constant sense of, do I belong, do I not belong? Do I belong, do I not belong? And the beloved, chasing her.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And then her reaching back. And it is the sense of finding, I belong in you. You belong in me. And that's the completion. And so it is the journey, but it's the journey of seeing, of really coming to terms with and settling with and owning who do we belong to.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that as you remark, it's ongoing, like multiple times the lover, she says, I am my beloved's, my beloved, mine. And then the story goes on, and then she needs to say it again, and he needs to say it again, that we do belong, and we know that. And we talked before about Henry Nouwen, you know, he always says, the one word I hope everyone could hear is, you are my beloved, you belong. But you can't just hear it once. It's just not settled for us. It has to go on again and again and again. You have to constantly be reminded. And again, that's part of what we gather to do every week. Michael?
Maybe kind of building off that. I mean, I was seeing themes kind of connecting throughout.
Okay, yeah.
I wasn't sure what to make with it until she said that. But until the whole idea of belonging. Because think about who is Israel? Like, the land they occupy was not theirs originally, right? And they developed as a nation from a single family whose descendants were put into slavery. It's like they have no, they're like not from a place.
Right, right.
I mean, It's like the Assyrians are from Assyria. The Egyptians are from Egypt. And,
right.
You know, Israel is not really from anywhere.
Israel's from the diaspora, as we say. The exile. Yeah. That's where they're from.
And so, so at the beginning, where it's talking about, you know, I wish we were like a brother, so that others I can and others wouldn't despise me.
Right.
Reminded me of Abram and Sarai.
Yeah.
When we go to Egypt, he's like, look, if we say that you're my wife, they're going to be jealous and they're going to kill me. So be like my sister.
Yeah, interesting connection.
And, you know, that way. And so then it's, you know, she's worried about being despised. And then later on, there's the idea, the, I don't know, the chorus or whoever saying, who is this coming
right
from the wilderness with the beloved? So it's kind of like maybe the other nations are saying, who are these people of God?
Mm-hmm.
They come from nowhere.
Right, from the exile, from the wilderness.
They are not a powerful nation per se. I mean, Solomon's time, they're starting to get some notoriety or fame. But, so it's just kind of like this idea of this love story, but then, you know, where is the woman coming from that is belonging to this man?
Right.
And all the issues that brings up with their social, political environment.
Right. I read a Jewish theologian one time who talked about exile as calling. Instead of running from the fact that we have no home, what if we embrace the fact and exile was our calling? Which is a crazy, interesting thing to say, you know, from their perspective. And I've seen Christian theologians build on that and talk about the diaspora, the spreading out among the world. What if that's your calling, as opposed to gathering in real close and protecting what we have, but rather go and be among others? And so there's interesting language. Who is this coming from the wilderness? They don't even have a home, and here they are coming to dwell among us, leaning on their beloved. You know, they're attending. They're aware of it. They're paying attention to it. They take notice of it. Interesting. Nolan.
Just coming back to the Jesus stuff, you know.
Yeah.
The wilderness with John, who's leaning upon her beloved, you know.
Yes.
John, right?
Yes, right? Imagery of Christ and John the Baptist.
And then the grave and death. Where is we're staying? Where is the victory?
Yes.
You know, it's the same. The parallels are just too striking, right? I mean, it's, obviously, it's language they're going to have in common even over the centuries, right?
Right.
That we see in the Old and the New Testament. But the idea being there, again, if we're trying to broaden this out to be not just creation, but perfection of creation,
right,
fulfillment of creation, the back and forth of creation, which is what is found in Jesus, if I'm reading that right.
Yeah.
You know, that's it's yeah, setting this that there's a lot of daring in here. There's a lot of commands in here. A lot of times it's set, look, listen, watch. You know, they're very directive. It's very participatory. There's a lot of passive stuff that happens out of the abundance and all that. There's things where it comes from, but it's a call to pay attention, I think, to be aware that these things exist, to look for that these connections are out there. You may not always get them. Again, flashes of fire. You know, it's not a constant thing, but there are these points. You know, that's that kind of idea that it's this give and take, this ebb and flow, but it's there, and it's part of the world we live in, the world we occupy. I think that it's the whole book overall, reading this way, it's been kind of illuminating for me in that way.
Yes, yeah. Oh, I love those connections, and I love the fact that it's calling us to attend to all of those little subtle connections constantly. They are there. Keep watching. And in fact, you reminded me of this. At the end where it says, make haste, my beloved, and it's like the last word. Interestingly, that is also the way that Revelation ends. Come, O Lord, come quickly. That's the way the New Testament ends. And it makes you wonder, did the writer of Revelation know the Song of Songs and thought, I'm ending it like that. Come, my beloved, come quickly. The word in Aramaic is Maranatha. It's the way this book ends. It's the way Revelation ends. Maranatha, come quickly. Make haste, my beloved. Again, just subtle little connections here that are lovely to notice. Yeah. Okay, others. What else have we heard? Bill?
I don't know why this kind of stuck out to me, was just that scene of labor under the apple tree.
Mm.
And for the Jews, I was just thinking of their all the laws that they upheld, their being clean, right?
Mm.
And I just felt like it was just a stark contrast kind of between the purity of love and the messiness of labor. I don't know. It just,
yeah.
I don't know why it's in my mind right now, but just thought I'd share it.
It is interesting when you connect love and new birth together, and we think about the result of the new birth is this beautiful baby that we all love, but birth itself is complicated, difficult, messy, right? And they're connecting love with that complication, difficulty, and messiness that, you know, that is a birth. That is interesting. And it's interesting to think about that as a labor, as the translation puts it here. And interesting, under the apple tree, I awakened you. The tree that we stand under, the tree that is the cross, there you're awakened and you do the work of love. You know, we were born under the cross. Stuff like that. There's interesting connections there for sure.
That's in contrast, too, to when she said, I want to bring you into the chamber where my mother bore me.
Mm.
Bring you into house.
Right, right.
It's like, no, it wasn't a house.
Yeah.
It was out in the vineyards, in the wilderness.
Right. Michael was talking about the contrast between bringing you into the chamber where my mother bore me and then the beloved saying, no, it was labor out under this tree in the wilderness in exile. Yeah, interesting. Anyone else on this passage? Any other things that stand out that the Spirit might be speaking?
Not trying to get political.
We have to have one comment every time that starts with not trying to get political, but... Mm-hmm.
There was, and I don't remember where, I think it was towards the beginning.
Okay.
Where it talked about the sense that I got, that I've reflected on, is the sense of, I would like to love like everybody else loves. I would like it to be seen.
Thanks.
And
I would like to love like everyone else does. I'd like it to be seen.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it's the despise me. And it makes me think of today, all of the ways that love is forbidden.
Right.
And it's the Christians that are despised. It is kind of that Christian nationalism thought that despises so much of the love that is not. And I just find it interesting that here it's saying, I want to love. Like if we are looking at this metaphor, that it's like, I want to love and be allowed to love and be public about it. And yet today, it's so many people who bear his name that won't let people love.
Yeah, there's a deep irony there. And I think these are profound verses, as Melinda's pointing out, verses 1 and 2. Whether it's through fears we carry culturally or even laws we carry culturally that... in some sense, prevents the very thing the Song of Songs is calling to be free and available to everyone. And where we find that, in the spirit of Song of Songs, we might want to, you know, stand against that to carry forward this spirit. So yeah, that's good. Again, I find it so intriguing on, you know, the literal level, celebrating human intimacy, and then also on the spiritual level, celebrating intimacy between humans and God. I do find it fascinating that the Song of Songs goes out of its way to elevate the female in the society they lived in. Far more involved in, you know, in making this duo work. But allegorically, it is fascinating to think that, you know, the line here, sorry, let's see if I can find it. As one who brings peace, I was in his eyes as one who brings peace, shalom, completeness, fullness, harmony, flourishing. As if our response to God, you know, to quote Jerry Maguire, completes God. And we think often about the way God completes us. Certainly, I mean, that seems great. But this relationship seems mutual and reciprocal. There is a oneness here that both parts of it are necessary for the union. And it's just interesting to think about and reflect on our responsibility in God's own peace, God's own wholeness and flourishing. I'm not sure I want to take that too far, other than just to say it is here in the song and worth attending to. Yeah, Spencer?
I think we should take it far. I've always had a problem with the idea of
just the Trinity. It feels like there's a piece missing. Mm.
And this will be our last comment. I'm just realizing what time it is. Yeah.
In American indigenous culture, we have the sacred wheel. It's not three parts, it's four. We are that fourth part. I don't believe that God is complete without, but what's the point of God if we are not here to complete that?
Mm-hmm.
God is very abstract, but when we add ourselves into those three parts, it becomes whole again. And through Christ, we achieve that, right? So taking it farther than we really want to, when we see us as that fourth part of the veil, the fourth part of the, if you will, Trinity, we can move deeper in with each other and see God in ourselves and each other more clearly.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's a great way to end this, and great thoughts on, from the moment, as our creation story tells it, from the moment that God decided to create, God decided and even says multiple times, I am not me without you. From this point on, I am not me without Israel, without the spiritual word, whatever that symbolizes, I am not me without you. God makes that decision. The song seems to celebrate it. We talk often about, you know, our life here is for communion with God, one another, ourselves, the non-human creation. And God's purpose is also communion. And therefore, God is, according to the songs, complete in communion with us. It's a lovely sentiment that the song brings out and worth reflecting on. Okay, let's pause there. And next week, we'll just do some wrap-up and summary and final thoughts on the Song of Songs and Scripture and the Word of God and all of that. So, all right, thanks, everyone. We'll see you back here in 7 minutes.